Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 158, Psychology, Economics, and Learning Communities, June 13, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
If we think that human nature is primarily competitive and then cooperation is what you do in order to achieve competitive advantage, you have a very different society than if you start with the assumption that the basic goal of human beings is to cooperate in order to meet their needs and sustain the ecology that they're dependent on and so forth. And that competition has a role to play within that cooperative arrangement. But the underpinning should be cooperative, not competitive.
That was the voice of my guest and longtime colleague, Dr. Art Warmuth. Arthur Warmuth, Ph.D., is professor of psychology at Sonoma State University in Northern California, where he's taught since 1969. He has served three terms as department chair and is currently chair of the Academic Planning Committee. He's also past president of the Association for Humanistic Psychology and has served as a member of Division 32, Humanistic Psychology of the American Psychological Association. He currently teaches community psychology and is involved in community projects related to sustainability, including complementary currencies and the economics of the commons. Dr. Warmuth has been involved in humanistic psychology since 1959, when he went to Brandeis University to pursue doctoral studies with Abraham H. Maslow. This was the period just following the publication of Maslow's groundbreaking Motivation and Personality. At the time, the use of the terms humanistic and existential were still being debated, and the idea of the third force, which Maslow introduced in his 1962 book, Towards a Psychology of Being, was still being formed. While at Sonoma State, he was co-founder with Dr. Eleanor Criswell of the Humanistic Psychology Institute, which is now Saybrook Graduate School in San Francisco. He also served as a founding consultant to the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology and has served on the boards of several nonprofit organizations. He has taught and consulted in Mexico with the Universidad Autónoma de La Laguna in Torreón. Dr. Warmuth has published in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, the AHP Perspective, the Sonoma Management Review, the Humanistic Psychologist, and Humanity and Society, among others. Now, here's the interview. Art Warmuth, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you.
Well, this is long overdue. I've been meaning to interview you for a long time now because you and I have been colleagues for more years than I want to say. And there's so many areas of your diverse career that we could delve into. But I think the one that stands out as most unique, perhaps, is your involvement as a psychologist who's very interested in economics. So I thought maybe that would be one place where we would start.
Actually, this is very good timing in terms of my relationship between my interest in psychology and my interest in economics, because things have kind of come full circle. I started out as a psychologist recognizing that my colleagues seemed to be acting like money just falls from the sky if you're sufficiently virtuous, and it didn't seem like that was quite how it works. So I went off on this odyssey of exploration of economic theory and economic systems and trying to understand money and so forth. But in the last probably half year or so, it's come back to psychology, because I've come to see that if you get into sufficient depth in terms of trying to understand what's going on with the economy and what's going on with money, it really relates to very fundamental questions of identity.
Interesting.
And, a lot of the resistance to thinking about alternative ways to run economic systems is really a very, very deep psychological level. And it has to do with our assumptions that money is the way it is, and really there's no point in questioning it. We just learn how to live with it.
It's, you know, it's interesting. Just yesterday, as synchronicity would have it, I was listening to a podcast interview with a guy at MIT who describes himself as a behavioral economist. And this is a guy with a background in cognitive psychology who then does research seeing how manipulating various environmental variables influences the way people behave as in various kinds of experimental economic situations. But that might be a little bit of a digression.
Well, I think that's one interesting area of intersection between psychology and economics. People are looking at incentives and how really things like expectations and reinforced behaviors influence stock market behavior, and how really the winners in the stock market, the big winners, tend to be essentially psychologists who can go in counterintuitive ways against the psychology of the crowd. But my sense of it goes, in a way, somewhat deeper. I think one of the things that kind of catalyzed my thinking about it was the recent book by Robert Reich, Supercapitalism. And he basically presents a model of our economic identity that has four components. One is as a worker, another is as a consumer, and then a third is as a saver investor, and the fourth is as a citizen. And his argument is that the economy, the way it's currently configured, takes really good care of us as consumers. You know, if you go to Walmart, you can get stuff very cheap, and the whole thing is aimed at lowering consumer prices. So consumers do all right. But workers don't do so hot because we're shipping all the jobs overseas in order to get the cheaper prices. And so that leaves the workers in the United States in a big quandary.
Right.
And then in terms of the saver investor, if you have enough savings to actually be able to afford to invest, you can do all right with mutual funds and stock markets and bonds and so forth. But all of this leads to us being essentially disempowered in our role as citizens, because an economic system is basically designed by a combination of tradition and public policy. And as history has progressed, it's been more in the direction of public policy and less in the direction of tradition. And the more it requires a sophisticated public policy, the more disempowered citizens are, because they don't understand economics and they aren't served by a political system that's really paying attention to their economic needs. Although there's some evidence in the recent Democratic campaign that finally people are catching on that they need to elect people who will serve their economic interests and not just play to identity politics or ideas about same-sex marriage and flaring flag pins and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I sure hope you're right about that. Robert Reich,
He was a Secretary of Labor for Clinton for a while.
Okay, yes.
And now he's teaching in Berkeley. I think he's taught various places. I think he was at Brandeis for a while.
Okay.
But he's one of the popular economists is very well worth reading, along with people like Robert Kuttner and so that's there is a lot of interesting stuff out there if people are willing to make the effort to educate themselves about how the economy works.
Well, I know one of the things that you've talked about and written about in the past is the commons and the importance of the commons. So where does that fit into your thinking these days?
Well, actually, that is becoming a increasingly widely recognized issue. Peter Barnes' book, Capitalism 3.0, basically argues that the conventional current economic system serves the markets very well, but it doesn't serve the commons. So kinds of things like quality of life and ecological sustainability are not really well served by the current political system. And he offers some alternative ideas. He thinks that the current political system can't do it because it's too short-term in its time horizons and too dependent upon big money and so forth. And so he advocates a concept called the Commons Trust, which would be an independent agency. It would be set up by government, but it would be given a charter that it's supposed to manage some area of the commons, like the wetlands or the forests or the ecosystem of Sonoma County, or actually in the case of universities, I think we could see ourselves as a commons that's entrusted with the intellectual life, the cultural life of society. But one of the problems that we have is that we're on this annual budgeting cycle, and when things get tight, we tend to get cut.
Isn't part of the problem that the commons in recent years has not been recognized as the commons, but rather right. everything's got to be got to support itself as a
in
a market,
in a market right.
And everything has to be entrepreneurial. We've been told
right.
at the university
right.
we have to be entrepreneurs right. rather than kind of being a protected entity for the public good.
Right, and in some sense, I think the notion that it should be protected is kind of sets a kind of defensive tone, whereas I think the reality is that the economics of the commons is different than the economics of markets. And markets do some things very well. They allocate resources to individual consumers, and they allocate resources in the production process for individual consumers. But there are a number of areas where we are collective producers and or collective consumers. And a university is a good example of that, because what we're really, what we're turning out is not just degrees and career opportunities for individual students. It's really the sophistication of the general public.
Okay.
And that's an aspect of the commons that needs to be recognized. And so it's not so much a question of protection, or there's often kind of a thing that, nonprofits, they require a charitable impulse, that it's not about self-interest, whereas when you're in the market, it is about self-interest. And in reality, they're both equally important parts of our self-interest.
Yes.
It's just that some of our self-interest is collective and some of our self-interest is individual.
Okay.
And that's where we get into the psychology, because there's a lot of programming in the way we're raised and the way we're taught to think about money that says that, self-interest is primarily taking care of number one, me as an individual, first of all. And secondly, an erroneous interpretation of Adam Smith's invisible hand concept, which is basically the notion that the market will take care of everything if people just pursue their individual interests, which is basically saying that the core economic motivation is greed, and that if we're all sufficiently greedy, then things will work out. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it is built into a lot of our conditioning, our propaganda in the media, our the way we train our children to primarily focus on competition rather than cooperation. And that's actually another major identity issue. Because if we think that human nature is primarily competitive and then cooperation is what you do in order to achieve competitive advantage, you have a very different society than if you start with the assumption that the basic goal of human beings is to cooperate in order to meet their needs and sustain the ecology that they're dependent on and so forth. And that competition has a role to play within that cooperative arrangement. But the underpinning should be cooperative, not competitive.
And I gather that latter
picture would be your view of human nature.
Right. And my view of, you know, my view of economic systems is that they should be designed to mobilize natural and human resources to meet human needs.
Yes.
And that the human needs we're talking about are represented by the whole range of needs that Maslow laid down in his hierarchy. Basic physiological and survival needs, but also needs for esteem and self-esteem, self-actualization, transcendence, which is kind of part of his hierarchy in his later period, and quality human relationships, love and belongingness. All of these things are really about human relationships. And we have an economy that's kind of in hock to the production of material goods, material satisfactions, and not very well designed to promote the satisfaction of the higher needs.
Right. I remember when Mother Teresa visited this country that she, at least what I heard she said, was that we were materially, we were very well off, but she thought that spiritually we were perhaps the poorest country she had visited, and that we were much worse off than the people in the slums that she worked with in India. By the way, I should let our listeners know, if they are hearing any background sounds, that actually we're having this conversation in an open courtyard at Sonoma State University, speaking of the commons.
Right. Yeah, the Mother Teresa thing is interesting because, as you're aware, Muhammad Yunus recently won the Nobel Peace Prize for his innovations in micro-lending, micro-banking. And he operates out of Bangladesh, and there is a economic indicator that's been developed by some folks called a happiness indicator. And it measures various quality of life kinds of things that indicate
right.
how happy people are.
Yeah.
And he at one point made the statement that Bangladesh is higher on the happiness indicator than the United States.
Yes, right.
And it's interesting that he won the Nobel Peace Prize, not the Nobel Prize for Economics, because the stuff that he's talking about is really fundamental rethinking of how what economic systems are and how they operate.
I'm a big believer in the micro lending movement myself. I'm very favorably impressed by an organization called Kiva.org. I don't know if you know them, but you should check it out.
Sure.
I've actually been lending money out there myself to small entrepreneurs around the world. It seems to me one of the more positive things. I hope to get that founder on to interview at some point.
It seems to be a pretty good investment.
Yeah.
Poor people are more reliable paying back loans than rich people.
Actually, the repayment is very, very good.
So.
And, you know, speaking of Maslow's hierarchy, you know, I get the rewards, those sort of transcendental kinds of awards of satisfaction, of feeling like I'm doing something good, something noble. Instead of getting interest back, I get that interest. And that is, I shouldn't say instead of, that's the kind of interest I get. And it's significant enough to me to want to do it.
Yeah, well, that's what Jerry Brown was talking about in terms of psychic income. And psychic income is very important, but you need enough material income in order to be able to relax and enjoy the psychic rewards. If you're
yes.
in dog-eat-dog competition for you know, a return on your investments, then and your only concept of wealth is the accumulation of money and material goods, then you're not in a very good position to really readjust your thinking in a way that takes advantage of these other opportunities. And actually, a point that I think is important to make is that part of the fundamentally competitive character of the economy has to do with the design of money, the way money is created. And this is something that has been dealt with at considerable length by Tom Greco from Arizona and Bernard Leotar, who actually was here on a academic visa for a while at Sonoma State. He's from Belgium, and I think he's back in Belgium.
And he had worked with the World Bank, right?
He had worked with
International Monetary Fund.
He was involved in Europe with the design of the euro.
Okay.
That was one of his claims to fame. And he's worked with various countries and banks and so forth on an international level. But the point that Greco and Lyotard make is that the way most money comes into being, is created, is by putting new money in accounts in banks that are created on the basis of loans. So a bank has to have a certain amount of reserves in its coffers, but if you take out a mortgage, most of the money that shows up in your checking account that you can spend is actually new money. And so it's the control of the creation of new money by the banking system that the Fed attempts to manage when it's trying to manage the money supply. And it tries to keep the quantity in circulation low enough so you don't get inflation in relation to the demand for money. And it also tries to pump more liquidity into the economy when we're looking at the possibility of recession. But the basic flaw in this system is that when the money is created in the account, there is an interest charge attached. So you have to pay back more money than was created, because you have to pay back the loan, plus you have to pay back the interest.
Sure.
And if the interest is never created, then there's always a shortage of money in the economy relative to the amount of money that's needed to pay back the debt that's been created. And so that shortage that's created because national currencies are what are called debt-based fiat currencies, that shortage that's created by the convention of interest, and it's made worse by compound interest, leads to the fact that there's always competition, and in some sense, at a fundamental level in the economic system, there's competition for money. But the point to really understand is that that competition is not created by human nature. It's created by the design of the monetary system.
Yeah, you know, this is, you're so much on the same page with this guy that I was listening to yesterday. Mm-hmm. I'll have to get his name for you, because he was making a very similar argument that we need to start with human nature, mm-hmm. and understand what our human capabilities are, how we process information, what our needs are, etc., and design a world that is in accord with that, rather than a more arbitrary kind of world that we then have to fit into, like round pegs and square holes.
Right, and the bottom line is that you need to start with redesigning the monetary system and the financial services system that serves the store of value function of money, because there are basically two major functions of money that economists recognize. One is a medium of exchange.
Yes.
And that's the money that's in circulation to massage the transactions that are going on in real time as we move forward. And the money to do that, the liquidity to do that, is always in short supply because of the way money is created, as I just explained. But then the second function is the store of value function of money. And that is where you want to take some money out of circulation now and invest it so it'll be there in the future when you want to actually spend it. And basically, John Maynard Keynes' explanation of recessions and depressions is that you get in a situation where the attention to save exceeds the intention to invest, and so the money supply dries up because of that. But there are all kinds of games, what Reich calls paper entrepreneurialism, that people who are experts in the financial services system can, investment banking and so forth, can play to accumulate cash, accumulate money.
And wreck lots of people's
lives
in the process.
Yeah. Yes. Without really contributing anything useful
right.
to the overall well-being of the economy, which is not to say that managing the relationship between savings and investment isn't useful. We need to have institutions that can do that. You know, we need to have institutions like the public employees retirement system, mutual funds, and so forth, that will manage our savings so that when we need them when we retire, there's something there that has real economic value. But it needs to be invested in processes that produce real value so that the money that isn't being spent on consumption can be spent on increasing the productivity of the economy. That's essentially the responsibility of the investment management community. And until, you know, so that's where Muhammad Yunus, you know, is operating in a region that has real integrity and is dealing with increases in the ability of people to create real wealth using relatively small amounts of capital.
Okay. Now, I know one of the things that you've been really interested in are local economies and barter economies, and that you, for years, you've tried to get something off the ground here in Sonoma County. I don't know if you're still working on that or not, but where does that fit into your...
I'm still working on that. Phil Beard is doing a lot of the legwork. There's a new kid on the block called Derek Huntington, who is... connected with the Sebastopol Economic Forum, where a lot of these discussions have been going on. He's actually in the investment services industry, so he understands the savings investment side of it as well as the local currency, complementary currency side of it. And the...
So what, as a psychologist, what is the value of having a local currency?
It can be created on system principles that are other than those that require debt-based money creation. So it can be created as a public utility that serves to provide liquidity in the community rather than as a commodity that people are trying to exploit in order to corner the market on currency.
Okay.
And it also insulates the local economy from the fluctuations in the national currency manipulations that go on globally and can suck, you know, liquidity out of a local economy overnight if it decides that that's what's supposed to happen.
Okay. I'm going to switch the focus a bit. It's probably not totally unrelated since you're involved with all of it. There's got to be a connective thread somewhere. I want to switch to your work with learning communities and kind of your philosophy of learning and teaching. Can we go there?
Sure. And actually,
maybe we can start with your, I know years ago you took a sabbatical and you went up to Evergreen State University.
The Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington.
Yeah.
And they do basically the whole curriculum in learning communities. We had a group of four faculty and slightly less than 100 students who were teaching a curriculum on human health and behavior. And we had a couple of psychologists, a biologist, and a political scientist were the faculty team. And among other things, we decided to go whole hog with student-initiated curriculum. And so and Evergreen is on the quarter system, so they're basically three quarters. So we used the first quarter to set up a faculty-designed curriculum based on addiction. But because a couple of members of the team really were into organizational development, group planning, and so forth, we basically set it up so that the students took the first semester to plan the first quarter to plan the curriculum for the subsequent two quarters. And so we had this great Halloween party where everybody came dressed as their favorite issue. And so it was a wildly festive occasion. But the result of it was that the students brought together more relevant information in the course of two quarters than any other educational experience I've ever been in. And it wasn't just using the faculty. Actually, the main function that we ended up playing as faculty members was in running the seminars where the students would come together to discuss their learnings and their experiences and process the information that they gathered in this guerrilla raid on the resources of Puget Sound. Because they went all over Puget Sound and brought in resource guest speakers, and I stripped down to my skivvies and had a massage by somebody who was demonstrating massage therapy, and it was incredibly dynamic, incredibly fast-paced, and I think ultimately incredibly effective.
And you were so impressed by that model that you, when you came back to Sonoma State University after that, you created something here, a set of courses called the Learning Community, and you've taught in that mode now for the past probably 15 or 20 years, right?
Right. Well, and actually, the Learning Community is its most successful was a joint effort of Mac McCrary and myself, and then a number of students that got on board during the first few semesters and then became teaching assistants and co-facilitators. And it includes actually Gisela Wendling, who's now the OD coordinator on the faculty, Wayne Downey, who is teaching psychology at the junior college, kind of a learning colony modality.
These are people who former students who've gone on to get PhDs.
And are working with the same model. Sandy Stein, who was a lecturer here for a number of years before she moved to Alaska.
Yeah.
So for many students, it gets them in touch with their own motivation for learning. And once they get really in touch with a self-motivated agenda, they take over and create a much richer curriculum than can be pre-designed by the faculty.
Well, I've been an outsider to this process, looking in more or less from the outside. And personally, I've not been able to tolerate the ambiguity. I think you have a much higher tolerance for ambiguity. There's a phase there, right, where they want you to provide the structure.
Right.
But you believe so deeply that they've got what it takes that you just sit back and insist on it.
And there's always the possibility that it won't resolve itself during the course of the semester and the class will be a total disaster. But that possibility hasn't yet been realized.
Uh-huh. And what I've seen, again, as an outsider and that I marvel at is how empowered the students are that come out of it, that they just, you kind of sit back and refuse to do many things that they expect you to do. And in the process, they end up doing them and learning that they can do stuff, and then they go out and they want to do all kinds of stuff.
Right, and the other part of it is that it's based on a concept of the essentially collaborative or cooperative basis of human nature. So that the things that are not done by the faculty get done by students in groups. They get organized in groups and they have to meet outside of class and so forth. So they take on a lot of this responsibility within a group setting that, they would otherwise expect to have spoon-fed for them from the faculty. And this actually has an epistemological basis. Kenneth Bruffy is one of the authors that's really written extensively about this, and he takes kind of a postmodern epistemology, which is characterized by Thomas Kuhn's concept of paradigms and paradigm shifts, and the notion that really our intellectual life is a collective affair. That people may be competing to be first to discover some new vaccine or something like that, but the framework within which that happens is essentially a commons. It's a collective body of information that's been accumulated, stood the test of time, knowledge methodologies, and so forth, that that are created by the academic profession or a particular discipline within the academic profession. that's essentially cooperative, essentially cumulative, and essentially makes people smarter than they would be individually.
And do you think, I'm phrasing it as a question, but it's probably more of an assertion, yeah, that technology is playing an important accelerative role. Some years ago, you and I actually taught a course together that we made up, and mm-hmm. we called it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think we called it the psychology and economics and technology and the future.
Something like that.
Something
like that.
That
was the curriculum anyway. I don't remember the title, but that was the curriculum. And I think, technology is accelerating the effective accumulation of knowledge, the accumulation of discipline-based databases and knowledge bases.
And students have access
students
to all
have
of
access
that now,
to it.
Right?
And the faculty has a hard time dealing with the fact that the students have so much access to this stuff. And with dealing with the fact that what we need to do now as faculty is help students figure out how to make sense of the somewhat historically unique information universe they find themselves in. And to be able to use the technology in ways that deal with the historically unique situations that exist in the community, which can be the campus community or a community like, you know, Santa Rosa, Roner Park, Sonoma. These are all unique communities with unique sets of problems that have incredible access to discipline-based cumulative information on a scale that never before was possible. And I'm, you know, the process of accumulating the information requires a lot less PhD level labor than it did in the old days when we were in graduate school. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember those mechanical calculating machines.
Oh, yes, I do.
You try to calculate the square root on a mechanical calculating machine, right? And the thing jumps all over the desk and clunks and clunks and clunks for several minutes. Finally spits out a number, you know, and then as a graduate student, you have to pull all these numbers together and do something with it that your major professor says is what you should be doing because you're learning about research, you're going to get a research degree. All of that stuff can be automated.
Yeah, and so much of that.
A professor needs maybe, you know, half-time graduate student to help with some of it, but he doesn't need 15 or 20 graduate students.
Right, and a lot of that, too, was after you did all that mechanical calculation, then you had to draw the graphs, and you had to create those by hand, and you had an India rubber eraser and a T-square, and it was a, particularly if you weren't artistically inclined, it was a terribly laborious process. And now all of that's really been automated with software and so on.
Right. And I think what we need now, and I think, you know, this has some really fundamental implications for how we ought to be reorganizing the university as a system, because we still need people who understand what the computer is doing and what the meaning of the results are. But what those people need to do is to be able to explain people who are operating at the master's level that are dealing with the applications of the disciplines in particular local, existentially unique situations, historically unique situations. So we need a lot more competent master's degree people in applied social sciences, humanities, sciences, and probably particularly in interdisciplinary applications.
Mm-hmm. So
they go across the disciplines.
And they'd be practitioners who are out there working in the world.
Practitioners or consultants or, educators for younger students in the educational system, high school teachers, middle school teachers, but facilitators, consultants, planners.
Well, in a way, this goes back to, it seems to me that a thrust of your work really, I talked about empowerment before, and a lot of what you've done is sort of moved in the direction of deprofessionalization or scaling it down. So what you're saying right now is a lot of the stuff that we used to think, well, you need a PhD to do this out in the world. You're saying, well, you could have a master's degree or even a bachelor's degree, or in some situations even less.
And actually make a difference.
And make important differences. Yeah. Now, a lot of that attitude, I think, is rooted in Carl Rogers' work and Maslow's work. And you were actually a Maslow's graduate student.
Right.
So let's talk about Rogers and Maslow.
Maslow was my committee chair. I knew Carl. I didn't know him well.
Okay.
But I was obviously, his writings on higher education were core to the curriculum at Brandeis, where I studied with Maslow. And the notion of person-centered education, person-centered values, learner-centered values, as well as the notion of the hierarchy of needs are two fundamental theoretical perspectives that have colored most of what I've done in various ways. I think that both Maslow and Rogers tended to downplay the role of the therapist and rely too much on theories about human nature. Because I'm more inclined to agree with Rollo May that human nature is pretty much almost infinitely malleable, depending on what you... That's probably an overstatement, but it's very malleable depending on what conditioning you experience in the process of growing up.
Okay.
And so, in terms of Rogers' system, you need to be paying as much attention to what needs to go on in the therapist to provide unconditional positive regard as you do to be paying attention to what goes on in the client when he experiences a context of unconditional positive regard. Because unconditional positive regard is not a universally accessible experience in, maybe particularly in U.S. culture, if some of these things about, India or Bangladesh or whatnot, where there's a different attitude toward human relationships and a different score on the happiness index, there may be more unconditional positive regard built into those cultures in certain ways than there is in ours. But in order to get to the satisfaction of the higher needs and to realize the self-actualization that Maslow and Rogers were both interested in, you need to pay attention to what's going on in the environment.
Yeah, so in other words, it's not just, it might be in the form of a therapist, but it might also be in the form of the system.
The system, yeah, it's basically
setup,
a system, an educational system, various political, cultural, social systems. They're all environments within which basic attitudes get developed, shaped, as I was saying earlier, it gets back to economics. The fact that the economic system is designed to create competitors and to create a climate within which competition is pretty fundamental, then leads to all kinds of consequences in terms of what us optimists would consider distortions in human relationships.
Okay, well, you know what? I think we're at a place where we need to wrap things up. So I think ending with the word us optimists is a good place for us to close it down.
Okay, well, good.
So thanks very much, Art Wormuth, for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It was a good chance to pull some thoughts together, and I hope people find them of some interest.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with my longtime colleague, Dr. Art Wormuth. The sound recording conditions weren't the best. I'm still getting my remote sound problems ironed out. It's better when I'm in my, quotes, studio. I don't know if it came through in this interview or not, but one of Art's most outstanding characteristics is that he is a visionary. I believe all of my psychology department colleagues would share that assessment with me. He's always had an eye out to the long term, and even more importantly, to a systems view of things. As you heard in my introduction, he's been instrumental in founding several humanistic, transpersonal-oriented graduate schools. He's also been an active force in the local community, and he's one of the respected diplomats in our academic subculture at Sonoma State University. Art loves to tinker with systems. I had known him for quite a few years before I got what I felt was a key insight into this propensity for tinkering with systems. My wife and I were invited over for dinner, and in the course of getting a tour of the house, Art took me down into the basement where I discovered a very extensive model train layout. He had multiple electric trains running through very elaborate rail crossings and switch points and signal towers and towns and countrysides. I think he even had an engineer's hat to go with it, if I recall correctly. The psychologist in me went, "Eureka! No wonder my friend likes to mess with systems so much." At some level, he's been doing it ever since he was a kid, and a great and widely beloved engineer he is.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
As a result of a suggestion from a listener, I received an invitation to join sciencepodcasters.org. This is a podcast site hosted by podcaster Dr. Ginger Campbell, who is an emergency room physician. She intends for sciencepodcasters.org to be a sort of portal to all the science-related podcasts. As you know, not all of my shows have a science orientation, but many of them do, and from time to time, I'll be double posting so that some of the shows on Shrink Wrap Radio will also appear at sciencepodcasters.org. I'm hoping this added exposure may help to grow our audience. Speaking of other podcast sites, you might be interested to know that my most recent podcast on Wise Counsel, which you can find at wisecounselpodcast.com, is with Yolanda Brown, an African-American woman who has successfully struggled with child abuse, depression, bipolar disorder, and ADD. She's an author, publisher, mentor to young women of color, and mental health activist. She also has her own regular podcast on Blog Talk Radio, and she recently interviewed me on her show there. If you wish to hear that interview, I've put a link to it under the In the Media menu tab on Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks to our wonderful volunteers, we now have 39 transcripts of our interviews that are either completed transcripts or are in process. Just go to the transcripts menu on Shrink Wrap Radio to find the links to these free transcripts. And please consider volunteering to do a transcript yourself, as Kip Watson recently did. There are still 5 slots open on our Top Spots widget where you can put a link to your own blog or website or your favorite blog or website for a $20 PayPal donation. You'll find that widget on the right-hand side of our page right at the top. Remember, the sponsors for this show are Mevio and GoDaddy. And listen up, because GoDaddy is still running, just for a short time now, a 25% discount through June 15, 2008. You can get a 25% discount off any order of $100 or more just by using the Shrink25 code at checkout from the GoDaddy site. This helps to support the show, by the way, if you do so. This is great for those of you who need to purchase bucket loads of domain names or who need hosting, bandwidth, or other services. And you can check out all of our GoDaddy discount codes, Shrink1, Shrink2, Shrink3, at our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. And if you click on the GoDaddy link on our page, it'll take you to another page where you'll find a bunch of Mevio promos and discounts, including 35 free tunes from eMusic.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio. ShrinkWrapRadio.com.
Thank you, Podfather Adam Curry. Let's look at some listener emails. First, we hear from longtime listener and blogger, Anna the Man, who writes, "Hi, David. Good that you mention it. I thought this was still the old service, allowing you to order a transcript for a fee." He's referring to the transcription announcement. He says, "This is an absolutely wonderful feature. I'm not sure how many listeners will actually use it, but where podcasts do offer a transcript, I love to use them as a source for my reviews. In my next review, I'll point to this feature on your site. It might be a good idea, though, to have the links with the issue to which it belongs in the row with the click to play and download. Have a link to the transcript there. That way, it will be much easier to find, more intuitive to find. I continue to be impressed how you keep improving your show, both on air and on the web. Anna." Thanks very much for that feedback, Anna. I noted your suggestion about where to place that transcript link, but I decided not to because it appears way at the bottom, and I want people to notice right at the beginning the transcript link, and the play button is down at the bottom. So that's why I'm sticking with the way it is, but I do appreciate the input. Next, we hear from Sarah Zeldman of SolutionsForBusyMoms.com, a coaching site for moms, who writes about our top 10 spots widget, saying, "Woohoo! You go, girl! Doctor. Sorry, I usually work with ladies. That's terrific. I can't wait to see what kind of response you get. Congrats on taking this step, Sarah Z." Well, actually, I wouldn't have taken the step without getting that as a suggestion in the first place from Sarah Z. So I'm glad to see that we've got 5 of our top 10 spots occupied, and hey, I'm holding my breath for another 5. Next, we get one that says, it's from Ken in Canada, who's been a longtime listener. Haven't heard from him for a while. He writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, it's been a long time since I've written, but I've just been listening along with you for all the while. I take a very special pride in knowing that I started listening somewhere in the 20s. Anyway, I'm writing because I know you love movies. I saw a movie the other night, and I was so surprised and impressed by it that I thought I'd send it your way. It is a deeply psychological movie, very moving, and so much not what the premise sounds like. It's called Lars and the Real Girl, and it starts out with one of my favorite actors, Ryan Gosling, who was in a great suspense movie. I'm sure you would like, also called Fracture with Anthony Hopkins, which I did see and which I did like very much." And he goes on to say, "Anyway, this Lars movie was so powerful and beautiful, I just thought you would love it. I haven't been much in contact with the shrink wrap community because I'm happy to say I'm a new father." Hey, congratulations. "But I've also loved every episode, and I'm so happy for the continued growth. The site looks awesome, by the way. The pictures of the guests really help. All my best, Ken Valerio, who is an artist, you'll recall, and you can look at his wonderful art at www.kenvalerio.com. Well, Ken, I have put Lars and the Real Girl on my Netflix queue, so it should be coming before too much longer. I saw the commercials for it, and I was turned off. You know, I thought, oh, this is some kind of weird fetishistic movie. But upon your recommendation, I'm willing to be open to it. And I hope the dulcet tones of my voice are getting pumped into your baby's brain as you listen so that a new listener will be imprinting. Next, we hear from Jody in Switzerland, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Van Nuys. I have recently enjoyed discovering Shrink Wrap Radio following the links connecting you to the work of Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. I am extremely interested in the body-psyche connection and have studied with Jungian analyst Marion Woodman, a very noted analyst, by the way, for a decade now, as well as beginning training at ISAP in Zurich. I'm not quite sure what ISAP stands for. Probably International Society of Analytical Psychology, that would be it, because the Jungian approach is called analytical psychology, so that's got to be it. She goes on to say, I would love to know more about, I'm assuming it's a she, Jody, it could be a guy, so apologies if I've made a gender error here. Jody goes on to say, I would love to know more details of the workshop you plan to do in Switzerland, as this is where I live. Please, could you share the details of this? Thanks and warm wishes, Jody. I've got to look at my site to see if it's still talking about an upcoming workshop in Switzerland. It might be that Jody heard one of the older shows and got that idea, because I did a workshop in Switzerland with my good friend Dr. Ron Alexander, but I think that's already 3 years ago. I would love to do workshops abroad or even in the U.S. elsewhere, and I don't have any planned, and all I need to do is have an eager listener in some location, put one together, sign up a bunch of people, charge them some money, send me the money, and I'll come. Write me if you're interested in setting up something like that. And Thea, a longtime listener, writes to comment briefly on my recent show about Second Life with Wagner James Au. And you'll recall I let it off with what sounded like a dream and then confessed that it was my experience in Second Life. And about that, she comments, very clever about the dream, and then it was really Second Life. Trey, cool. And that was from Thea. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. I'm almost all caught up on the emails, so I need some new ones. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails for me on Skype, where the name is ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages by clicking on the My Chingo button on our site and then talking into your microphone. And you can, if you don't have a microphone, then use your phone and call 206-337-0622. Leave some cool voice transition so I don't have to use an old one like the one I just did from Adam Curry, although I'll never throw that endorsement away. Thanks again to Dr. Art Wormuth for speaking with us about his work on psychology and economics and learning communities. And on next week's show, my guest will be Dennis Palumbo, a former screenwriter turned Hollywood shrink to the stars. You won't want to miss his unique insights into the perils and pitfalls of stardom. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.